and welcome to the Eastern Art Podcast. My name is Phil Ward and I'm Director of the Eastern Art Consortium that brings together the Universities of East Anglia, UEA, Essex and Kent. In these podcasts we talk to colleagues at the three universities and beyond to explore current issues and challenges in the wider world, as well as discussing some of their own work. Last year we talked to four researchers about a project that looked at volunteering in the four nations of the UK during the pandemic. At the time, they had just received funding from the Economic and Social Research Council, the ESRC, and were just beginning to get started on the research. We're going to be talking to them a year on to see how the project went, what they learnt, and where they go from here. As well as two of the original researchers, we're going to be talking to others who undertook the research within each of the four nations. I'll let them introduce themselves, starting with Irene Hardell, who is a principal investigator on the project.
So I'm Professor of Public Policy at Northumbria University. I'm a member of the UK coordinating team, and I'm also principal investigator on the project.
Hi, I'm Eddie Hogg. I'm a senior lecturer in social policy at the University of Kent. And I was involved in the project really from day zero with Jürgen Grotz, who sadly is not with us today. That sounded like he was dead. Sorry, can I start that again?
No, we're going to keep that in. That's great.
Sadly, Jürgen is away today. He is very much fit and healthy. And we had this idea really to look at the way in which volunteering was responded to COVID, and particularly the way in which policy and policy decisions were facilitating or constraining that response. And from the little acorn of Jürgen and I's imagination, we never dreamed of this giant oak tree of this project. And it's been wonderful to see it grow in that way.
Yeah, hopefully it will lead to a whole forest. Rhys, can I come to you next?
Thanks, Phil. I'm Rhys Davidson-Jones. I'm a social geographer at Aberystwyth University. My research interest more broadly is in migration and civil society. And I've been involved in this project as the academic lead, in want of a better phrase, looking at the Wales case study. And I was working with Dr. Sally Rees and James Lundy from the Wales Council of Voluntary Activity.
I'm Matthew Linning, so I head up the research and evaluation function at Volunteer Scotland and been overseeing the research element relevant to Scotland as part of the UK-wide team. And this research builds on our pre-existing and current ongoing COVID-related research. So it's an extra and interesting complementary bit of research which gives a wider non-Scottish perspective.
I'm Denise Hayward. I'm Chief Executive for Volunteer Now. We're a support organisation for volunteering in Northern Ireland. And so we've been also doing our own research locally as well. But this opportunity to be part of a much wider project has been fantastic for us because it's really reinforced our local impressions of what's been going on as well.
Hi, I'm Amy McGarvey from NCVO, Research and Insight Manager. And so I've been working on the kind of England strand of the research in particular. I've been working on the project since June when I came back from maternity leave, but ably led by colleagues in the run up to that. And it's been a really great project to be part of.
Laura, finally, can I come to you?
Laura Crawford, I was the Senior Research Fellow on the project. I'm currently a lecturer in Human Geography at the University of Birmingham, and I worked across the project in the different work packages alongside Irene and Jürgen, and I'm really glad we get to reflect on what we've done with yourself today.
What a perfect place to start the conversation, because that's really what I want to do today. We talked, I think it was about a year ago, just as the project was starting off, and getting a sense of how it came together, how you put together a research project in lockdown was a fascinating part of the discussion. How the network and the collaboration came about, the relationships you already had, and what you wanted to get out of the project. I've been re-listening to that podcast, and it's almost a historic artifact now. So catching up on that, seeing how things have panned out, has it been as you expected? Really, to start with, maybe Laura, it would be interesting to get your view, because you were there managing the whole thing to a certain extent and coordinating this complex project. What is your impression of how it went? What were the challenges? What were the opportunities? Your thoughts on how it went?
something that surprised me, or I found a lot easier than expected, was just how quickly we struck up a rapport as a team. I thought, you know, we're all working remotely. Many of us have never met each other. How is this actually going to materialise in practice? But I think under Irene's leadership, we've really established a really good working relationship across the team. I think some of the challenges were just how to make sense of all the different stories that we were hearing from different types of organisations working in different places.
It has been at times challenging, but it has been hugely helped, I think, by a few factors. If anyone were thinking of embarking in a project of this nature, I mean, I would say hire Laura, but other Lauras are available, I'm sure. But find someone who is going to be the central hub. It has made a huge, huge difference. And the working relationship that Laura got up immediately, not just with Irene and Jürgen at the centre of the project, but also with all of the different spokes of the project, made a huge, huge difference. Looking around the room, I've actually never met Laura. I have met Amy and I have met Irene. But we are a group who have met in this context lots and lots of times. And everything from Jürgen's use of lift music in the lobby of meetings on Zoom to the sort of warm and friendly faces that we have here, it has worked really well. But that hasn't been by chance. That's been because of the system of sort of cooperation and support that Irene initially and then Laura put in place. And that's what's made it work. Otherwise, this would have been the loosest and baggiest of monsters as we all tried to do various different things in different directions.
We took a bit of time to build up a network, and we used trusting networks because some of us knew other people, but not the whole network. So we built up a level of sort of openness, trust and flexibility when we were actually designing the proposal. And we all co-produced it, so we had sort of co-ownership, I think. We were writing a proposal in the first lockdown, and then we got it in a period of uncertainty. This spirit of collaboration and trust has worked, and we've done it all virtually. I've got to say that it's been a most pleasurable project. It's been a challenge, and I don't know why we said we would do all that we said we would do, but we've done it.
Maybe one of the questions we can follow through on is at the end, what would you do differently? How would you do things differently if you were going to do it again? But I'd be really interested to hear how in the various nations of the UK, how the research actually took place on the ground, how the evidence was gathered, the kind of surveys and interviews that took place. So if I could do a virtual tour of the UK. Rhys, can I start with you?
Yes, of course. So to give an overview of the data we collected, there was two main strands. We had a survey, which we undertook in sort of the late spring, early summer of 2021, and then five interviews with key stakeholders from a range of different organisations, different scale of organisations, different scope and focus as well. With the interviews, we co-produced the questions, but we didn't want to replicate a lot of the studies that had already been done. We were very much wary of a sense of fatigue, of asking similar questions to the same people time and time again. So it was useful having James and Sally's own experience and expertise here in deciding questions could be asked that add to something rather than just replicate the same kind of questions. And we also drew on a Welsh Parliament report that had been published in the spring of 2020, which was focusing on some of the issues at hand as well. So that was really helpful in thinking about things to build on these. We had the interviews in later on in 2020, in September 2020, in late August. Those provided an opportunity to expand on some of the things from the interview, but also to highlight some of the other issues as well.
Denise, can I pop across the sea and see what was happening in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, a bit actually. Like Rhys, we did a survey, which we did in May, June, and we surveyed organisations that weren't, some of them directly involved volunteers, but they were also mostly infrastructure support organisations or local councils or local trusts, because we felt that there had been a bit of survey fatigue. There'd been a lot of surveying in our sector and a lot of grassroots organisations were just fed up with it. So we didn't want to kind of end up pitching it at the wrong level and get no response or a very poor response. So we did that survey, and actually we did really well. We had a great response, which was very, very pleasing. We also did the interviews then, which were based on some of the early results from the research so that we could see what the themes were that were emerging from the survey. And then we used those as well to kind of help us shape the questions for the interviews. And those were with some regional kind of government officials and some local government officials, as well as regional infrastructure support bodies and a local infrastructure support body. So we got that kind of regional local mix, which picked up on some of the different issues that we were seeing emerging as well. And we'd also very fortunately worked with Matthew and colleagues in Volunteer Ireland and Queen's Belfast to do a little bit of an overview of the public response. So we had that as well to draw on, which was useful because we published that report in March 2021. You lose track of time in COVID. I think COVID time has addled all our brains, but yes, that was March this year. And we were fortunate to be able to work with Volunteer Scotland and Volunteer Ireland to be able to look, we all used the same set of questions at three different intervals. So it was interesting to see how things were changing in the way the public was responding to volunteering as well. And that fed into what we were thinking and informed our thinking about our survey as well.
So in all the different jurisdictions, were you able to design the projects discreetly, or was there an overall template that the central team was using?
Actually, it was really nice because we all had central questions and there were some core questions that we all asked, but then we all had the flexibility to look at what was specific to our own nation. And I think that really added value to the whole project because it's given that central dynamic where you can look at what was consistent, but we can also say, well, yes, but this was slightly different in Northern Ireland, or this was slightly different in Wales or Scotland. So, and even we did a seminar last week for Northern Ireland, and you could see just the little nuances and things that were slightly different in the four nations, and that's really valuable.
Matthew, can I come to you and Scotland now for your experience? How does what both Rhys and Denise have spoken about chime with your experience?
Yeah, I think there's a strong read across between the different countries and our approaches. We had the same overall methodology to approach, and clearly there's some nuances in how the actual elements were played out. There's a good joint working, I think that was referenced there by Denise, which is great, on the sort of, in Scotland, it was Ipsos Mori that undertook the research of the public back in the first lockdown. The first thing I'd like to just say about the specifics of Scotland is that I think we're a victim of our own success. We actually have got too much data. You can never say that as a researcher, but really the biggest problem we've got is we started, one of the first tasks was to actually look at the secondary data that was already there, or the stuff that we had generated ourselves through Ipsos Mori. And, you know, we've got the Office of the Scottish Charity Regulator in Scotland, which has done two major surveys, you know, 4,500 charities in May 2020, followed up by another 2,500 in November. So an incredibly rich data set, of which we've taken their raw data and data sharing agreements with them to analyse that evidence. So we're incredibly fortunate, but it all takes time and effort. So there's that piece of work. There's also the Third Sector Interface Scotland Network, which commissioned another 1,000 organisations in the third sector in Scotland. And so it goes on. So we've actually got kind of really rich evidence base before we even start doing new stuff. The next stage really was the actually doing the research, which was bespoke to MVA. And in Scotland, we had this basic opportunity to do a joint piece of research with the Scottish Government. They committed to undertaking a significant piece of research on the impact of COVID in the voluntary sector. And we said, this does not make sense for you to do a survey and for us to do a survey in parallel. So we did it collaboratively. That had its upsides and downsides. I mean, it's a great thing to do, but it was a very ambitious survey. It was quite wide ranging. So again, we've got another massive data set. The whole thing is actually, we now land up the situation of producing a report with a lot of evidence. The other elements, I think we're just in the thick of doing our, well, there are only four face-to-face interviews, but they're already two of them are incredibly helpful in giving the policy perspective. So you talk about, you as a researcher, the importance of triangulation evidence. Wow, this is really important. And I think the last thing I would mention is the mid-project briefing expo in Scotland, which was really helpful.
Amy, can I come to you now? We've done the rest of the UK. Can I come to England?
In terms of the methodology, reflecting, you know, what we heard from other nations, we did lots of desk research. We also did a survey like the other nations. We got 127 responses for that. We, you know, experienced the same as in the other nations with some survey fatigue. So we did find it quite hard with the local authorities in particular. And I think one of the challenges with England perhaps is that obviously we've got a kind of bigger scale, a lot more local authorities, kind of bigger geographic area. You know, trying to make sure that we captured that scale was one of our challenges. And we also did some follow-up interviews to do some case studies with some of those who responded to the survey. And then we carried out a workshop as well. So that was kind of the first phase of our research, which we fed into our mid-project briefing. And then in the autumn, we had some more desk research, drawing a lot on Ewan's policy analysis, because our second report was much more focused on the policy response to the pandemic, as well as some in-depth interviews and another workshop. Again, this workshop actually wasn't part of our original methodology, but we felt that it was important to capture what the kind of impact of the policy response was on the ground. It was nice to have the kind of knowing what we should work to as a nation, but also the flexibility to kind of add and amend things as we went along to make sure that we were really kind of getting the most of things. And then we had our national event as well to kind of feedback. Yeah, that the methodology worked really well for us. But as with the other nations, it's been a busy time and lots of different types of data to kind of bring together.
We have an embarrassment of data. The challenge is distilling down from that. We've already been producing key outputs during the currency of the award. So we've had podcasts that you know about, Phil, briefing papers, think pieces, working papers, each nation's held events, mid-projects, and we're now at going through our final briefings in each nation. We've taken on an extra thing. We haven't signed the contract yet, but Policy Press emailed yesterday to say that they'd like us to produce a book. We've got to get the all the text by April, and the book will be published in the summer. It'll be a wonderful legacy for the project, and it's going to be open access, so free to download.
So it sounds like there was a huge amount of flexibility within the project to allow each of the nations to work to the specific needs of their organisations, of their governments and so forth. And really, I'd like to think about what your initial findings are. You've talked about, you know, already having briefing papers, think pieces, national events and so forth. Could you share some of the initial, perhaps top level findings that that have come out of the project?
I think the first high-level finding is there's a lot that unites the stories of voluntary action across the four nations, but policy frameworks and the degree of partnership working and trust that government has built up with the sector varies an awful lot between the nations. The third thing I'll say is that these uncertain times have been an enormous challenge for the voluntary sector and for volunteers. We don't know what's happening next week. There's been so much fear in living everyday lives. Some people have felt this fear more than others, and life has changed out of all recognition for many people. But the one constancy has been the willingness of strangers to help others and the important structures and support that the voluntary sector provides to be the conduit to help sustain mutual aid, philanthropy, whatever we want to call it. But this great kindness that characterises citizens of each of our nations.
I agree with everything Irene has said. One thing I would add is this hasn't been one pandemic. I think it could be quite easy to see it as having been an event, whereas actually there have been multiple different phases of it that have each been experienced quite differently across different spaces of the UK. So that not just meaning the four nations, but also meaning within those nations. There are significant differences as to how different bits of the UK have experienced this period of time. And I think from the voluntary action point of view, one of the things we think or that we've found that's been absolutely fascinating is the way in which different forms of voluntary action have thrived and declined over the course of the pandemic. From that initial outpouring of mutual aid and the creation of this vast, not massively connected network of mutual aid organizations, from the huge sign up to the RVS Good Sam app, to seeing that actually begin to decline away even in that first summer, as some of those organizations became more formal, some of the existing more formal organizations began to recover, having initially declined. And then more recently, the growth of the and the success of the vaccinations volunteering program, something, you know, a volunteering program on a scale that we haven't seen since London 2012. But I think that probably needs to be considered by those of us who are reflecting on how you sustain that in quite a similar way to how we consider event volunteering, rather than how we might consider kind of social welfare volunteering. So there's these different phases that have manifested themselves differently in different places. And I think that's absolutely fascinating. And I think it would have been very hard to find that without the size and scale of the project that we've had here.
For me, something I've just found interesting that's cropped up in all of the jurisdictions is the importance of kind of collaboration, partnership working and relationship building. During the pandemic, you've seen, you know, we've had countless examples of organisations working together that previously wouldn't have really connected on projects or working with communities. And I think it's prompted us to focus and look at what is it that either enables or constrains those collaborative relationships to flourish. We've explored things like funding, the importance of infrastructure, social and community-led infrastructure, and how that impacts kind of responses on the ground. So I think there's a lot we can take away from that across the UK.
Leading on from what you've all said, and particularly Irene, when you talked about a lot uniting the four nations, but also how policies, partnerships and trust has varied a huge amount. Are there particular any of the one nations or examples within the nations of where they have been particularly successful in the face of the pandemic?
In Scotland, I think building on what Laura was saying, the one thing that was really struck us from the evidence, how the network of third sector interfaces, so they're basically like the volunteer centres for Scotland. They've got a broader remit than just volunteering, but they, and there's one per local authority in Scotland. And I think it's fair to say that pre-COVID, the kind of authority and voice that the TSIs had, if you take just, for example, the local resilience partnerships that have been established in Scotland, so clearly there was a focus on the voluntary sector, but the extent to which the third sector interfaces were actually actively engaged and other leading voluntary partners around the table was mixed around Scotland. And I think really what we've seen is quite a sea change. And I think it was because when a crisis hits, which is 100% focused on in terms of response of actually where the volunteering have got a critical role to play, then the local authorities did not have that expertise. So you go, you always go to where the expertise lies, and the TSIs have that in spades. And I think that was a great outcome. And I think it's recognised from both parties, you know, and I think government as well. And I think it's a real positive. And it's one of the things we need to look at and build on in going forward. And that's certainly one area. The other one I would highlight would be policy, absolutely top of the list. So in Scotland, we've got a brilliant linked relationship with government in the policy area relating to volunteering. But I mean, it's like a tiny fraction of a huge monolith of a bureaucracy and infrastructure. And actually, how do you actually get the community section, the business domain, policy area, and each of these ones, all health and working, where volunteering applies to all of them? That's the big challenge.
Rhys, in Wales, is there that same positive relationship between the voluntary sector and government?
I think, yes, I think there are very strong relations there, and that's something which did come across, the County Voluntary Councils in particular being seen as particularly trusted conduits of information. This is particularly important, I think, in the case of Wales. We don't have, to the same degree as in Scotland, Northern Ireland, daily newspapers which have a Welsh edition. There was often a challenge in the Welsh-specific regulations and so forth being communicated. And again, from the interviews, we have CVCs in particular, other voluntary organisations being seen as, again, trusted conduits of information and so forth there. What we did also see is perhaps a disparity, I guess, in some ways, at work across Wales around the relationships between voluntary sectors and local authorities. And some did have very clear and established relationships between emergency planning and involving the voluntary organisation. There was a bit of variety across areas as well. That's something to reflect on. There's a lot of organisations in Wales. You have 22 local authorities, and there was a sense in some of the respondents of perhaps there being too many organisations doing very similar things and sometimes competing with each other. But the flip side of that is that you do have very focused, very tailored, and indeed very, very trusted organisations as well that respond to specific needs, either in localities or various communities as well. So it's a bit of a challenge to think about how you negotiate that tension as well. And that's something I don't have any answers for, unfortunately.
This is perhaps a difficult question to ask, a loaded question, but do you think the voluntary sector will come out of the pandemic, both in terms of the organisations themselves, but also in terms of the network and structure? Will it come out of it stronger and more resilient than it went into it?
It's hard to say. I think in some respects, the voluntary sector is severely wounded. I think a generation of volunteers, and a very important one to a lot of organisations, aged 70 and over, have been now away from volunteering, at least in a face-to-face sense, for a long time. And recapturing that habit is going to be very hard for organisations. On top of that, I think that, and we haven't looked at financials here, but organisations have really suffered in terms of furloughing staff, of dipping into resources to continue other things. And we know that a number of volunteer managers were furloughed, and that will have a lasting knock-on effect. On the other side of it, there are positive things. We have seen, as Irene said, amazing outpourings of support, and groups who weren't previously particularly well engaged in volunteering becoming engaged. The key, as is ever, is to sustaining that engagement in some way. That doesn't mean that everyone who signed up for the app, everyone who formed a mutual aid organisation, is going to carry on volunteering indefinitely. But it means capturing some of that energy that we've seen. We know now that people are keen to help their neighbours when they see a well-expressed need and when they feel that they can help by doing something. And it's about capturing that. And that's where, as a sector, if we can get this right, and it's why this project and its outcomes are so exciting, I think there really is an opportunity there. So classic academics answer, I've sat on the fence. I've said there are good things and bad things. But I do think there are real challenges, and we can't shy away from them, but there are also opportunities. So it's not as straightforward as, is it in a good or bad place? It's in a different place, and that's going to be a challenge, but potentially a positive one.
I sort of agree with the point that he's made, but I also want to do the other academic thing of being a little bit provocative here, if I can. If we take resilience to sort of mean a bounce back ability back to the same trajectory, it's a question of, do we want to continue on the same trajectory? And rather than perhaps thinking about resilience, should we also be thinking about resourcefulness as an alternative formulation, and that responds to the communities, to the grassroots, makes use of indigenous knowledge, folk knowledges, experiences, priorities, and so forth as well. And I think that's something which certainly came across in some of the interviews that we did. We can't carry on. Something has to change. And a lot of the questions were around funding and access to support for the voluntary sector, recognition of the significance of the voluntary sector, both in providing the role, but also a lot of the labour and the emotional labour done as well by participants. And I think sometimes there's a feeling of, well, if you're volunteering, you're just giving your time and anything, it doesn't matter. You don't need the resources, you're giving your time and that's enough. And it goes far more beyond that. There's a lot that isn't acknowledged in terms of the labour, the emotional labour, people providing their own resources so that that organisation can function because of a lack of funding. So I think there's perhaps a way maybe to push back a little bit about what do we mean by resilience, and do we really want to carry on the same trajectory? And is it an opportunity to rethink, you know, where we want to go perhaps in the future?
If you take the international context, you know, there's a difference between the crisis response and resilience. And I think that's what a lot of Scotland was set up for. It was set up for effectively the flood or the terrorist attack or the, this sort of thing, not something that's going on for two, three, potentially how many years, we don't know. And I think the big thing that we, I think we've all learned this and we've all shared our learnings across the four countries. We actually learned quite quickly how to deal with the immediate resilience stuff, and resources came to bear quite effectively. And we've seen after the end of the first lockdown, a lot of those immediate crisis things will never resolve, but a lot was done to help that. Whereas the pre-existing societal problems, and we know this list is, you know, as long as your arm, but top of the list generally has certainly been social isolation and loneliness, mental health, but then the list goes on and on and on to domestic abuse, sexual abuse, you go on down the list. And these pre-existing problems have been generally very significantly exacerbated. So actually, if we go beyond and we look at recovery and beyond recovery, the actual long-term challenges is how we can actually apply societal resources to try and tackle these really systemic, long-term, intractable in many ways problems in parallel with trying to get out of COVID. And I think that's really one of the big kind of learning lessons, certainly in Scotland, is how we take this forward.
The pandemic has really exposed kind of what was there before. And I think we had some quite challenging findings, which could come across as kind of critical at times. But I think at the same time, it's also a real opportunity to take on board those learnings and do something with them, I guess. So, for example, one of the kind of things that came up was around the kind of need for a strategic direction. And, you know, we have the vision for volunteering, which is going at the moment and due to be kind of released next year. And I think there's a bit of momentum at the moment to take learnings and then to kind of do something with it. So notwithstanding the many challenges that for the sector kind of going forwards, and I think there are lots of concerns. But hopefully we can see some of the opportunities as well to build on some of the positives that have come out of all of this.
Thank you. I really wanted to follow up and perhaps finish on some of the points you alluded to there, Amy, about doing. What are you going to do with the findings? What are the next steps? Irene mentioned the book coming out, some of the policy papers and so forth that have been developed and released. Can you give me an idea, a sense of how you will make sure that the findings of your research are used and felt by the end users, the people who can benefit from them?
We've been producing things, as we've already said, during the currency of the award. And what's been so important is through the networks and contacts with the sector, we've used them, as you probably gathered, to validate and inform our emerging findings. Through these networks, we've been able to consult. So hopefully we're already having an impact. And then the one major thing that's left is to do the UK synthesis, and that's going to be produced in January. So I think what we've done is try to share knowledge and validate knowledge during the award, and then we've got this period now we've gained for reflection.
So really my final question is, do you have plans to build on this? You've got plans to disseminate, to exchange the knowledge and the findings that have come out of it. What are your plans going forward?
The work we're doing in Scotland is actually only just starting. So we've got an incredibly rich evidence base with I think some really strong conclusions and really strongly evidence-based conclusions. So, you know, we might have the 27th of January as the end of this project kind of contractually, but really it's just the start in Scotland. So it's the timing couldn't be better, because a volunteering action plan that's been under development with the lead of the Scottish Government. So these outputs can really blend in to the development. What are the priorities for Scotland's action plan for the next 10 years? So, yeah, it's exciting times, and the timing couldn't be better, really.
I mean, I guess a bit like Matthew, we don't see, you know, the end of January as the end of the road for us. The research for us definitely raised some challenges, and we as NCVO even kind of see our position in that. And, you know, we're not just kind of standing away and saying, you know, we're not part of what next. How can we take the findings and learnings and what do we do next with them? I mentioned the vision for volunteering. We're very much kind of feeding our findings into that to make sure that it's part of what's developed there, as well as, you know, looking at how the learnings could be fed into our kind of practical support offer. You know, we have lots and lots of members as NCVO, so we want to make sure that some of the things that we've learned from even a practical level are fed into that.
I guess from an academic perspective, I'm also interested in how it sort of links into some of the other work I've been involved in Wales, the Wales Institute of Social and Economic Research Data, Wizards, a research centre looking at civil stratification and civil repair at the moment. And again, there's probably a lot of synergies there with sort of other work being undertaken by colleagues in other institutions in Wales around that. And hopefully there's opportunities to I guess, discuss some of these things and also bring together those academics, practitioners, policymakers again in the future. So I said already, it's the start of the journey, not the end.
The traction that we've got now in the sharing of knowledge across the nations is really helpful in informing, sharing examples of good practice, strengthen networks that existed before the project. The project's been able to build on those networks, and that there'll be a conduit for sharing knowledge that will continue beyond.
As Rhys said, this is the start of the journey, not the end. The project has gathered a huge amount of data and is already engaging with stakeholders, policymakers, and other end users who will be using the findings to deepen their understanding and to learn from the experience of the pandemic. The project has demonstrated how important and relevant co-created, engaged research is to address real-world problems. I hope we can continue to talk to the team as the impact of the research continues to be felt far beyond Eastern Arc. My thanks to all the participants today. Irene Hardell, Eddie Hogg, Laura Crawford, Rhys Stafford-Jones, Denise Haywood, Matthew Linning, and Amy McGarvey. Thanks also to everyone involved in producing this podcast, including Jeff Harvey and Chris Martin, who wrote and performed the music for the episode. This and all of our podcasts are available on our website at www.easternarc.ac.uk/podcasts. I hope you can join me again next time when we continue to explore the research of Eastern Arc.